Thank you, Josh. Good morning, everybody, and welcome to the Unitarian Church on St. Stephen's Green. It's been quite a while since I've actually been at a service, so for those of you who don't know me, my name is Keith Troughton. So let us begin. Come into this place of peace, and let its silence heal your spirit. Come into this place of memory, and let its history warm your soul. Come into this place of prophecy and power, and let its vision change your heart. Each morning, we must hold out the chalice of our own being to receive, to carry, and give back. Let us pray. All that matters is to be one with the living God, to be a creature in the house of the God of life, like a cat asleep on a chair, at peace, in peace, and at one with the master of the house, with the mistress, at home in the house of the living, sleeping on the hearth and yawning before the fire. Sleeping on the hearth of the living world, yawning at home before the fire of life, feeling the presence of the living God like a great reassurance, a deep calm in the heart, a presence as of the master sitting at the board in his own and greatest being in the house of life. Amen. Let us say together the prayer that Jesus taught us. Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread. And now I'd like to invite Elaine Harris to come forward and read for us.
Hi everyone, it's nice to be back in person here. As Keith said, I'm Elaine Harris. I've been a member of the community here for quite a number of years. And the reading I'm going to do today is from a book called Sapiens, A Brief History of Humankind by Yuval Harari. Probably like a lot of you here, I've been on a bit of a journey during COVID. And my journey has taken me from where I have been in science for the last 30 odd years to dip my toe tentatively back in studying for a BA for history and archaeology. And I absolutely love it. And it's opened up a whole new world for me of interest and reading that I've given myself the space to do. And one of the books I've read is this book. And it's nice because it combines history and archaeology and science, so it sits right in my sweet spot. And the passage I'm going to read today is called The Benefits of Idolatry. And it comes with the usual Unitarian warning. This is something that speaks to me. If it doesn't speak to you, that's absolutely fine. 2,000 years of monotheistic brainwashing have caused most Westerners to see polytheism as ignorant and childish idolatry. This is an unjust stereotype. In order to understand the inner logic of polytheism, it is necessary to grasp the central idea buttressing the belief in many gods. Polytheism does not necessarily dispute the existence of a single power or law governing the entire universe. In fact, most polytheist and even animist religions recognize such a supreme power that stands behind all the different gods, demons, and holy rocks. In classical Greek polytheism, Zeus, Hera, Apollo, and their colleagues were subject to an omnipotent and all-encompassing power, fate, Moira, Anike. Nordic gods, too, were enthralled to fate, which doomed them to perish in the cataclysm of Ragnarok, the twilight of the gods. In the polytheistic religions of the Yoruba of West Africa, all gods were born from the supreme god Olodumare and subject to him. In Hindu polytheism, a single principle, Atman, controls the myriad of gods and spirits, humankinds, and the biological and physical world. Atman is the eternal essence or soul of the entire universe, as well as of every individual and every phenomenon. The fundamental insight of polytheism, which distinguishes it from monotheism, is that the supreme power governing the world is devoid of interests and biases, and therefore it is unconcerned with the mundane desires, cares, and worries of humans. It's pointless to ask this power for a victory in war, for health, or for rain, because from its all-encompassing vantage point, it makes no difference whether a particular kingdom wins or loses, whether a particular city prospers or withers, whether a particular person recuperates or dies. The Greeks did not waste any sacrifices on fate, and Hindus built no temples to Atman. The only reason to approach the supreme power of the universe would be to renounce all desires and embrace the bad along with the good, to embrace even defeat, poverty, sickness, and death. Thus, some Hindus, known as sadhus or sannyasis, devote their entire lives to uniting with Atman, thereby achieving enlightenment. They strive to see the world from the viewpoint of his fundamental principle, to realize that from its eternal perspective, all mundane desires and fears are meaningless and ephemeral phenomena. Most Hindus, however, are not sadhus. They are sunk deep in the morass of mundane concerns, where Atman is not much help. For assistance in such matters, Hindus approach the gods with their partial powers. Precisely because their powers are partial rather than all-encompassing, gods such as Ganesh, Lakshmi, and Sarasvati have interests and biases. Humans can therefore make deals with them and rely on their help in order to win wars and recuperate from illnesses. They are necessarily many of the smaller powers, since once you start dividing up the all-encompassing power of a supreme principle, you'll end up inevitably with more than one deity, hence the plurality of gods. The insight of polytheism is conducive to far-reaching religious tolerance. Since polytheists believe, on the one hand, in one supreme and completely disinterested power, and on the other hand, in many partial and biased powers, there is no difficulty for devotees of one god to accept the existence and efficacy of other gods. Polytheism is inherently open-minded and rarely persecutes heretics or infidels. Even when polytheists conquered huge empires, they did not try to convert their subjects. The Egyptians, the Romans, and the Aztecs did not send missionaries to foreign lands to spread the worship of Osiris or Jupiter or Huitzilopochtli, the chief Aztec god. They certainly didn't dispatch armies for that purpose. Subject peoples throughout the empire were expected to respect the empire's gods and rituals, since these gods and rituals protected and legitimized the empire. Yet, they were not required to give up their local gods and rituals. In the Aztec Empire, subject people were obliged to build temples for the Aztec gods, but these temples were built alongside those of local gods rather than in their stead. In many cases, the imperial relief have adopted gods and rituals of the subject people. The Romans, for example, happily added the Asian god Cybele and the Egyptian god Isis to their pantheons. Thank you.
For my reading today, I've chosen a couple of pages from Carl Ove Nusgaard's, I believe that's the correct pronunciation, Inadvertent, which is actually a lecture he gave in America. The contradiction between the illimitable that dwells within us and our simultaneous limitation and earth-boundedness is a driving force behind all literature and all art, or so I believe. But not only that, the longing to equalize the difference, suspend the contradiction, and simply exist in the world undifferentiated from it is also an important part of all religious practice. Almost nowhere is a battle between the illimitable within and the external limitations more apparent and striking than in the case of Vincent van Gogh, the painter, since he at first didn't have access to any language at all. When he began to paint at the age of 26, he didn't know how to paint, nor did he have any obvious talent, unlike most other painters, in the sense that painting comes easily to them from an early age. They have the manual dexterity, the compositional skill, and the sense of color required to produce of a similar image of reality. Van Gogh didn't have any of this. His figures were misshapen, his forms crooked and mean, his colors dark and lacking assurance, as if the paintbrush were his adversary, as if he were wading heavily through a swamp in the darkness, while his contemporaries strolled across a sunlit meadow. He was on fire, driven by an intense will to communicate his inner world to the outer one. But the resistance was too great. The language he had access to was incapable of expressing it. But his will was as wild as it was blind. Little by little, the distance was whittled away until he produced his final paintings, painted only 10 years after his first, and which are simple and rich and dizzyingly intense, full of an existential yearning which it is difficult to remain indifferent to. Van Gogh found a language, not for the illimitable within him, but for the longing of the illimitable to overcome the limitations of the external world and become one with it. Now I'm going to read a short poem, after which we'll have a silence for some meditation, contemplation, or reflection, and that'll be followed by a piece of music by Josh. I asked God if it was okay to be melodramatic, and she said yes. I asked her if it was okay to be short, and she said it sure is. I asked her if I could wear nail polish or not wear nail polish. And she said, honey, she calls me that sometimes. She said you can do just exactly what you want to. Thanks, God, I said. And is it even okay if I don't paragraph my letters? Sweet cakes, God said. Who knows where she picked that up? What I'm telling you is yes, yes, yes.
Thank you.
Bridget asked me for a title for my service a few weeks ago, and I gave her the title Presence. Whether this sermon should have actually been called Presence, I don't know. Having used words by Nusgord for my reading, I decided to quote him a few times in my sermon. He reputedly has over 800 pages of beginnings that he's never used. The spirit seemed to be catching, and when I sat down to write my sermon, I ended up with a few different beginnings, and no doubt a different ending. Such is the nature of life. My working title became Starting from Zero, Presence. Zero is always a good place to start, so long as we get something from it, and zero isn't the end product, then all will not have been lost. Here goes. You know those newspaper and magazine interviews, those often found in weekend supplements, where they ask a series of short questions to reveal something of the character of the interviewee. Sometimes one of those questions is, what's a book you've read that influenced your life or that's impacted on your life? Well, one of those books, for me, is one that I've actually never read. Or at least, I've read a little, but I've never finished it. I'm not even sure if I got further than page 12 of the introduction, because that's where the last page is marked. It's the Bhagavad Gita, As It Is. It's a beautifully illustrated version of the book. I'll leave it there if anybody wants to have a look at it later on. It really is quite beautiful. And I keep it close to my desk as a reminder. You see, it was, I believe, the tipping point that pushed me over the edge into a mental breakdown. And when I asked him, does he read? He says, I'll tell you, hon, I read a little, but not enough to hurt me none. These are lyrics from The Lip, sung by Louis Prima and Keeley Smith. Coincidentally, the song was published in 1956, the year that I was born. At first glance, it would appear that I read more than was good for me, but it turned out not to be so. I was rescued by books, among other things. I won't go into the detail of what happened, except to say that in the immediate aftermath, presence took on a whole new meaning for me. I knew that the chaotic thoughts in my mind were leading me down a dangerous path, and simple day-to-day activity took a lot of effort. For example, walking over an unremarkable bridge required great concentration. I had to force myself over it one step at a time. Driving, though I'd done it for years, needed me to remind myself, this is what I do for each gear change. Each maneuver was a step-by-step process. I needed to be present to the very basics of life, to stop the sense of anxiety and fear overwhelming me. That stage of recovery didn't last long, but it was a lesson in being present. I'm a long way from those times now. More than a quarter of a century has passed. I'd like to think that there's less madness in my head, though some of my friends may think otherwise. But he taught me that being present, being in the here and now, if you will, has different stages. In an emergency, there's no time to dream, no time for thought about the bigger questions of life, no time for concepts like existentialism or anything of that ilk. When life is hard, presence can have a different meaning than when it's not. Hard times can come and go. At 65, it's my experience that there's no gentle incline of progression steadily reaching ever upwards to a peak of awareness, to some utopian presence. The wedding ceremony we perform here makes that clear. Over the horizon of the future, there come towards you even now hours of brightness and hours of shadow, for such is the nature of life. It doesn't matter what position we hold in life, what age we are, whether we're married or not. Thankfully, for those of us who have the intellectual curiosity, along with the financial wherewithal and security of life's circumstances, there are times when it's possible to be present to things that lie beyond the limits of the moment. Reading Nausgaard's book, I came across a section where he writes that we believe in science and our lives are dominated by its conception of the world. He also writes that science provides no answers to the ultimate questions, those we begin to ask ourselves as children and which we perhaps seek to avoid in our daily lives, but which are there below the surface of our lives, and which occasionally, perhaps on a cold and clear autumn evening, as you get out of your car and head to the house and look up at the multitude of stars, you cannot stop yourself asking, what is the world? Where does it come from? What is the meaning of life? Where does this meaning come from? Who am I? Nausgaard, being Norwegian, might have more opportunity than most to observe the stars on a cold and clear autumn evening. I've been to Norway, not quite the very far north of it, but to the Lofoten Islands, and there is something about the quality of the light there, maybe being nearer the pole, but at night time really is, the stars are exquisite. Looking at the stars for me has tended to be a summer night's occupation. At my age, I tend to need to go to the loo in the middle of the night when the stars are at their best. And to quote a verse from Philip Larkin's poem, Sad Steps, groping back to bed after a piss, I part thick curtains and am startled by the rapid clouds, the moon's cleanliness. Thankfully, I'm in the happy position of now having the resources to be able to grapple with the bigger questions in life. As Nausgaard infers, a childlike curiosity is an important starting point, but that curiosity can be crushed by an insecure home life, lack of money to pay bills, the expectations of family, controlling partners, a restrictive society, war, mental illness, and any number of things. If we're lucky enough, in Albert Einstein's words, to learn from yesterday, live for today, hope for tomorrow, and not stop questioning, then maybe, just maybe, we can part thick curtains once in a while. Einstein might disagree, or might not, but Nausgaard likens science's attempts in searching for the answers to questions like, what is the meaning of life? Who am I? To a clown, who as he bends down to pick up his hat, ends up kicking it even farther away. He says that we need art and religion to give us the answers. I tend to agree with him. Science and reason are obviously important. Reason is a tenet of this church, and it's reason that helps us make sense of the world, helps us discover and invent. But perhaps we don't invent. Perhaps we remember. In Robert Bly's A Little Book on the Human Shadow, he starts chapter 2 off with, it's an old Gnostic tradition that we don't invent things, we just remember. that everything is already here appeals greatly to me, that to see what is not yet visible, not yet discovered or invented, is an act of remembrance. There is a sense of holy presence in that, and I like that feeling very much indeed. For my part, I know nothing with any certainty, but the sight of the stars makes me dream. These are words of Vincent van Gogh himself. They sit on my desk in front of me, written on a card. They're there to remind me that I'm a small, but I hope important part of something much greater. The arts have a valuable part in giving us access to such vision and presence, to take us out of the day-to-day and open our eyes and hearts to something bigger. I love these words by Van Gogh, words that stir the imagination. In my earlier reading, Nausgaard posits that Van Gogh found a language not for the illimitable within him, but for the longing of the illimitable to overcome the limitations of the external world and become one with it. I stood in front of a Van Gogh once, wheatfield with crows, and I began to cry. And I can feel the emotion now. Maybe it was the sheer beauty of it. Maybe it was knowing what cost it was to the man to paint like that. Or just maybe it was something else I saw. Perhaps Van Gogh found a language I could understand, that he could express the holy presence of being both a separate part of something and yet part of that something. One of my favorite albums at the moment is Bruce Springsteen's The Ghost of Tom Joad, and in particular the song of the same title. It's not a new album, I don't know how old it is. Josh, you any idea?
Mid-90s,
there you go. Thank you. I had no idea till very recently that some of the lyrics are words from the 1940s film version of The Grapes of Wrath, the film being based on Steinbeck's book of the same name. The main character, Tom Joad, is played by Henry Fonda. Here's Tom Joad and his mother, Ma Joad, who was played by Jane Darwell. Tom. Well, maybe it's like Casey says. Fella ain't got a soul of his own, just a little piece of a big soul, the one big soul that belongs to everybody. Then what, Tom? Then it don't matter. I'll be around in the dark. I'll be everywhere. Wherever you look, wherever there's a fight so hungry people can eat, I'll be there. Wherever there's a cop beating up a guy, I'll be there. A human being is a part of the whole called by us universe, a part limited in time and space. More words from Albert Einstein. They sound very like those from Tom Joad and The Grapes of Wrath. The same concept that Nausgaard explores through the person of Vincent van Gogh, we the limited being part of the illimitable. Reading Silence in the Age of Noise, this little book here, by Arlen Karg, another book written by a Norwegian, I came across these words. Eternity, the moment or experience of having found the pearl, absolutely does not exist in time, writes the philosopher Søren Kierkegaard. In general, time is an endless succession where one second leads to the next. But suddenly, the experience of time is changed A succession is no longer endless after all. One second no longer leads to the next. Time is halted, and the present is no longer in opposition to the past and future in the annulled succession, as Kierkegaard formulated it. We experience the fullness of time in the moment that stands still, and there is only the eternal present, a holy present. The fullness of time in the moment could be another description of heaven on earth. Thy will be done on earth as it is in heaven. All that matters is to be one with the living God, to be a creature in the house of God of life. These words are from the prayer I used earlier in the service. The prayer is, in fact, the poem Pax by D.H. Lawrence. God is not out there, and we don't look at reality. We look from reality. We're in the middle of it now. We're a part of it. The whole thing is a mystery of participation. These are words from the American Catholic monk Richard Rohr. Are all these not other ways of saying the same thing, of asking us to live in the presence of the eternal moment? Different words, but expressions of the same thing. Invitations to live a life that is open to being with the eternal, to be willing to explore the illimitable that might exist within our limited lifespan, that does exist here, now. To open our senses, our minds, and our hearts to the living moment, to be present in the eternal. Perhaps it's like the Gnostic tradition goes. It's a case of remembering that the eternal is already here. Amen. Now we'll have our notices. First of all, can I thank Josh and Gavin for the music, Kevin for looking after things, and Elaine for her reading. And also my friend Jan Åge Pettersen, who's a Norwegian and tried to coach me on how to pronounce Norwegian names correctly. I've probably butchered them, but I've done my best. And we'll now have our final blessing.
We extinguish this flame, but not the light of truth, the warmth of community, or the fire of the new.